treating gun violence like an infectious disease. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. An epidemiologist spent years treating tuberculosis across the globe. Then he started studying the data on gun violence in America, and it hit him.
This is behaving exactly like an infectious disease. Someone has picked this up from someone else, and they pass it on to someone else and pass it on to someone else.
Plus, Indian-American comic Aziz Ansari looks back at his parents' arranged marriage. He remembers asking his dad about the two women he met before deciding.
Like, what was wrong with the first lady? And he's like, she was a little bit too tall. And then he like met my mom, was like, all right, perfect height. And they got married like a week later.
Talking Romance with Aziz Ansari, coming up today on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with support from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for being with us today. When you don't get any good news for a while, I'm sure it's hard to deal with what could be a tantalizing bit of maybe good news. That's what some families of the passengers on Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 are going through after a piece of plane debris washed ashore on Reunion Island, a French territory in the Indian Ocean. No official word yet on whether this part actually came from the missing plane, and so the families wait, as they've done for almost a year and a half now, ever since the plane disappeared with 239 passengers and crew on board.
I mean, it's been a roller coaster ride. I mean, we've been through so many stories, so many theories. I mean, unless they come up with something concrete and with real evidence to prove something, I mean, you're just speculating.
That man's sister was on MH370. We'll hear more from him and other relatives of the missing. First, though, what can investigators do with this new find? I asked Di Whittingham, head of Britain's Flight Safety Committee and a former senior officer in the Royal Air Force.
Well, they'll start by looking for any identification marks that have come up during manufacture. It's a rotable part. In other words, it's replaceable. And for that reason, there will be a tracking plate on it. And of course, there'll be forensics, which will allow them to trace and test through other batches of carbon fiber and the metal itself.
So every part on every plane has a unique identifier. These are replaceable parts, right? So somebody somewhere has this written down?
Replaceable parts, they do get tracked. So they're recorded at manufacture. And that's to allow the manufacturers to go back and engineer out any defects that might have come in to replace when they get fatigue cracking or something like that. You know, that's normal business with aviation. And it also allows them to make sure that parts aren't being extended beyond their design life.
How long has that been going on? I mean, it seems crazy, but I guess brand new cars have the same deal.
Yeah, they do. Manufacturers know which cars they've issued and when they were made and where they were made and what was in them. So airplanes are just the same.
So it will be helpful to have those numbers. But given the vast currents in the Indian Ocean, once the kind of identification is established, how long could it take to identify where this plane debris actually drifted from and to track back to that point?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I think that, firstly, we need to make sure we don't jump the gun too much by assuming that this part is from MH370, although all the evidence is pointing in that direction. It looks very much from the drawings and the photographs that it's a 777 part. So you would expect the system to want to be absolutely 100% certain before they announce it officially. What will be happening now is that the oceanographers will be busy modelling, and some of these forecasts have been done already, but I suspect they'll be using that information to try and refine the search area. Now, that search area itself is also difficult because if you think back to the Air France 447 accident where the aircraft went down off the South American coast, even though they knew the impact point within about 5 miles, it took them 2 years to find the flight recorders.
Right.
And until they find the flight recorders, we're not really going to know what happened to that airplane.
So let me take just a step further. I know you said you need those flight recorders to tell what happened to the airplane, but can this wreckage, can this debris tell us anything about what might have caused the crash?
It's possible. It may be, for example, you find signs of sooting on it, which would have shown an airborne fire. It may be that you find signs of a failure in the metal or the construction itself, which can show there was a fatigue failure. I don't think it's particularly likely in this case. Or, as we've seen with MH17, you know, clear signs of a strike with high-speed missile fragments. I don't think we're into that scenario. So it may tell us a little bit about the speed that the aircraft was doing when it hit the water, assuming it did hit the water, which appears to be the case. But in terms of finding out the exact mechanism, you've got one small part of the jigsaw, very small part at the moment.
There's been some suggestion that, you know, this is a flap that could have just fallen off of any plane. Do you believe that?
No, I don't. Because there is a reporting system, a global reporting system, which would have required the manufacturer to have been notified of something, because that could have been a failure mechanism that would have affected the entire fleet. And it's part of the flight control system. It's a flapperon, appears to be, which is a flap that also acts as a bit of roll control as well. So you would expect that to have been reported, and the manufacturers would have been doing something about that. So that information would be out there. It isn't, and the inference is it's come from an aircraft that's down in the sea.
Di Whittingham is head of the UK's Flight Safety Committee. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So that's what the experts are up against as they study the latest discovery in the search for MH370. Here's what's going through the minds of some family members of the missing.
There have been so many stories and so many theories and so many unanswered questions.
Bimal Sharma has served as a captain with India's Merchant Navy. His sister Chandrika was a passenger on Flight 370.
My entire family is watching this very closely, everybody in my family. And that includes Chandrika's mother also. She's 90 years old, and it could be any wreckage. I mean, it could be something, could be another aircraft. I don't know. They haven't come up with anything concrete. I mean, it's been a roller coaster ride, and it's still a ride.
Same thing for Grace Subbatharai Nathan. She and her family are still hoping to find out what happened to her mother, Anne Daisy.
Well, of course, we're very shocked and anxious, and, you know, like, you just feel like you've been thrown back into that loop one more time, all over again, for the umpteenth time. So, I mean, we're not to say, like, we're taking it as the truth, because it's happened so many times before, so we're wary of the information. So I think we're also holding out hope until it's confirmed, and we understand that, you know, that there's a high likelihood or there's a high chance that this might be it. But, you know, till then, we still have to hold out hope.
Even if the part that washed ashore in Reunion is confirmed to be from MH370, Nathan says she still needs to know how and why the plane went down. Jaquita Gomez's husband was also on board. She says she's not even sure if she wants to hear that this piece of debris belongs to the missing plane.
Yes, that they have found the aircraft, then we can have some sort of closure until they bring the whole aircraft back. And then I can give my husband the peace that he needs. The other part is that, no, let it not be true, because then we can still have hope that, you know, there's a chance that the plane is still out there and then they all can come home.
The most difficult part's not knowing anything.
That's Australian Jeanette Maguire. She's hoping the debris found this week will help her learn the fate of her sister and brother-in-law.
We're all longing and waiting so much for any sort of news that is, you know, valid. But when we get it, I think it's going to be another emotional roller coaster.
Jeanette Maguire there, one of the many people whose loved ones went missing aboard Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 nearly a year and a half ago. The jungle, even the name of the place, gives you a sense of the desperation and misery of what's happening in Calais in northern France. Let me get you up to speed with a story which is the latest chapter in the migrant crisis in Europe. Britain is facing a swarm of migrants trying to enter the country illegally through the Channel Tunnel from France. That's according to Prime Minister David Cameron. As they prepare to enter the tunnel for the hike under the English Channel to Great Britain, the migrants hang in a shanty town known as the jungle. Just in the last week, more than 3,000 attempts have been made to enter the tunnel. Joining me now is Pascal Froli. He's one of the French volunteers who distributes clothes and food to people living in the jungle. Tell me what conditions were like when you last visited the shanty town.
Last time was this morning. We brought them some wood. So it's the worst kind of shantytown because they are left to their own devices to build shelters with the help of a few people, few local people. Some of them are quite well organized, but they have very limited means. So they can only provide them with covers and some pieces of wood and some nails and hammers to build whatever shelter they can build.
Describe what the shantytown, the jungle, actually looks like. How big is it?
It's huge. You know, they used not to be tolerated in the area, but the local authorities have finally realized that there was no way of deterring them from going to Calais.
Yeah, how do the people of Calais still feel about the shantytown so close by?
Well, some of them are worried. Most of them have compassion for those people. There's a lot of talk about crime and things like that. I've heard a lot of talk about them carrying knives, which is true, sometimes iron bars, which I'm not denying. But we had a distribution of clothes last Saturday, and I can tell you they were quite orderly. Nobody threatened me. We had a few laughs together. My own perception of them is not as worrying as it might seem.
But still, there are worrying elements all along this route with these migrants, people who shadow them like smugglers. So as a town, it must be, you know, have all the elements of a town, including those smugglers. How do you know you're not propping up any criminal elements that may be inside the jungle?
Well, it is a fact that the smugglers are part of the problem, and some of them are the worst kind of criminals. That is true. So they are dangerous people. They take advantage of human suffering. It's that bad.
Is that the concern for the people of Calais?
Well, you know, what can I tell you? This is a depressed area. We have a lot of unemployment, which shows you that Calais is not what attracts them. The reason why they're in Calais in the first place is that they want to go to England.
Up there in northern France, in Calais, these migrants are kind of at the end of the line if they can't move on to England, if they can't get across, if they can't make it through the...
And many of them try. You know, they didn't aim at going to Britain when they started their journey.
Right.
So they're doing it as a last resort.
Where are most of these migrants in the jungle outside Calais? Where are they mostly from?
Yes, this changes all the time. You see, right now it's a majority of Sudanese people. But years ago we had many Afghans. We also had quite a few Kurdish people, many Eritreans, many Palestinians.
Why are you doing this volunteer work on behalf of these migrants?
Being a Calais man, I see this misery every single day of my life. So I can't help feeling compassion. I have seen with my own eyes a family of man, his wife, and a child who had slept in the snow. They had spent the night that way.
Pascal Folli, thank you very much for your time and speaking with us today.
My pleasure.
That was Pascal Folli. He's one of the volunteers who distributes clothes and food to the migrants living in a camp called The Jungle in Calais in northern France. Coming up, an Iranian family here and there, and their different thoughts about the Iranian nuclear deal. That's later here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. I don't know if you're keeping count, but you know there's been a disturbing number of news stories about guns and violence here in the U.S. recently. In Charleston, in Chattanooga, and in Lafayette, Louisiana, all high-profile incidents. But much of the gun violence that goes on in this country actually gets very little attention. It's community-based. We're going to hear about a program now that's been showing success in reducing gun violence in urban communities. It's led by a doctor who spent years in Africa and Asia trying to curb the spread of tuberculosis and HIV. Here's more from our colleague Amy Costello, host of the Tiny Spark podcast.
Autry Phillips is a church leader and community activist in Chicago. About a decade ago, the neighborhood where he was working was consumed by gun violence.
Looking at upwards of 50 shootings a year, community was in a uproar. And one of the things that clergy was trying to do was go out on the corners and try to resolve problems that we knew nothing about, honestly. So when we met the doc, it was honestly more of a eye-opening for most of us.
The doc he's talking about is Gary Slutkin, a physician and epidemiologist trained in infectious disease. He fought cholera and tuberculosis in Somalia during the 1980s and later AIDS in Uganda. He also worked at the World Health Organization, and after a decade abroad, he moved back home.
When I returned to the United States and I began to see about kids shooting each other and began asking people questions about, okay, what are you guys doing about it? And nothing was making sense that they were saying, I then recognized this as what we at World Health would call a stuck problem. Because there were too many answers and none of them made sense and none of them were working.
So Slutkin started looking for patterns. He pulled out charts, graphs, and maps. After a while, the epidemiologist saw something about gun violence in America that looked eerily familiar.
This is the same kind of graph that I've been dealing with my whole life. This is the same kind of map. Same kind of clustering. I just said, this is behaving exactly like an infectious disease.
Wait a second. Gun violence as an infectious disease? Slutkin says it helps if you look at it that way, rather than as a crime with a victim and a perpetrator.
I don't like victim and perpetrator language at all. The someone who has active tuberculosis and passes it on to his son, is there a perpetrator in there? And a victim. But this guy, he got the TB years ago from his best friend. So was it conscious or unconscious? Was it controlled? Because objectively, that's what's happening in violence, is that someone has picked this up from someone else and they pass it on to someone else and pass it on to someone else.
To stop people from killing each other with guns, Slutkin would reach into the same toolkit he'd used combating TB and AIDS, namely find local leaders, train them, and have them teach the community how to stop the deaths plaguing their neighborhoods. The program used to be called Cease Fire and now goes by Cure Violence. It's been featured in the documentary The Interrupters. Cure Violence has been active in 25 cities around the world, including in Iraq and Honduras. And there's evidence that it works. According to an independent study, gun homicides were reduced by half in one Baltimore neighborhood after the program stepped in. Another evaluation showed the program reduced gun violence in high-crime neighborhoods in Chicago.
It wasn't about trying to stop people from shooting, but it was more about changing the norms of individuals.
Autry Phillips says he's seen the changes. Cure Violence brings together teams of people who go into neighborhoods after a gang-related shooting. Phillips' colleagues have gone out in the middle of the night to talk to an armed man bent on killing a rival. Here's how they would urge someone to choose another route.
The best thing that we can do for that individual is remind him of the consequences of pulling that trigger. We ask him to think past right now. And it's 2 hours later. You've pulled the trigger. Someone else is dead. And now the police is looking for you. Right now, what I want you to do is think about Mama right now. What would Mama have you to do? Would Dad be pleased with you right now? But more importantly, how is this going to affect you 2 hours from now?
Sometimes, says Slutkin, these kinds of negotiations go on not just for hours or days, but for months. Kind of like any success in global health, real change occurs through hard work, not over days, but years. For The World, I'm Amy Costello.
Amy mentioned that the group Cure Violence has been active in Iraq, and we wanted to know more about that. So we called up Brent Decker. He's worked with Cure Violence since 2003, and he's the guy who helped get the Iraq program off the ground. Decker says that when Gary Slutkin brought up the idea of applying violence interruption in Iraq, he was skeptical.
When Gary first approached me about it, I was like, this guy must be crazy. You know what I mean? That was kind of my first response to it.
But Decker says they went ahead and adapted the program. They trained local people to do the interventions and translated training materials into Arabic. The project started in Basra in the south of Iraq in 2008. It's a largely Shiite city, but Decker says they also worked with Sunni and Christian community leaders. The idea remained the same as here in the U.S., bring in local people who can tell when violence is about to break out and who have the credibility to intervene and stop it. Decker says, yes, there were cultural differences between Basra and Baltimore. For one thing, tribes play a big role in Iraq, so the teams engage with tribal leaders. In the end, though, he says what really surprised him was how similar things were. Violence would erupt over the simplest things.
It could have been anywhere. It was fights about, you know, in Basra, there was only power on for 4 hours, so people had, like, their private generators, and this would be maybe someone, like, plugging into a generator or over things like someone looking at my, quote unquote, my woman the wrong way. I mean, it was very, like, minor things, but I think in the context of some of the larger conflicts, it quickly would kind of ignite.
He says sometimes they would mediate in cases that involve sectarian tensions and militia violence, but the focus was largely on community conflicts. Cure Violence wrapped up their work in Iraq in 2013 after U.S. funding ran out, though Decker says the local groups still use some of the group's techniques. Since Iraq, Cure Violence has branched out into other countries. Their focus now is on interrupting violence in communities in Mexico and Central America. Before we take a short break, a quick note about one of the most remote places we know.
It looks like an alien landscape made entirely out of ice and snow.
That was not one of the commanders of NASA's New Horizons mission, and he's not talking about Pluto, where the little spaceship discovered incredible ice mountains during its flyby earlier this month. No, that was, in fact, our reporter Ari Daniel. He called in on Monday from Greenland, where he was camped out on the edge of a glacier. Ari's up there right now reporting on ice and climate change for the world and our partners at NOVA. We spoke with him on Monday by satellite phone, and tomorrow you can speak to him yourself, sort of. Ari's going to be hosting an AMA on Reddit. That's AMA as in Ask Me Anything, and it'll actually be on the science subreddit. Those of you who know this stuff will know how to find it. For the rest of us, there are details on our Facebook page. One thing I didn't get to ask Ari the other day was, what is it like to witness in person some icebergs calve off of a glacier? I've seen film clips, and it's awesome. And I know that word is overused, but it is awesome. Like a 30-story building falling into the sea. So I might log on and ask him that. You can ask your own questions on Reddit tomorrow at noon Eastern. And if you want an idea of what Ari's seeing, we've got his pictures on our Instagram feed. We're at PRI The World. You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Comedian Aziz Ansari knows his way around a punchline. He's also an expert on the online dating profiles of the Japanese.
They don't post photos of themselves. They just post photos of random stuff. And I ask, like, what kind of photos? And they're like, oh, they'll post a photo of maybe their cat or a rice cooker. A guy's like, hey, I can make rice. Let's do this.
Aziz Ansari tackles modern romance ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like French, filet crochet, and front flips. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Every now and then, I look at all the people on the street plugged into their earbuds. And even though I'm in a happy relationship, I think about the women I've met over the years just because of a conversation that started on a sidewalk somewhere. How do you do that these days when everyone's too busy with their devices? Romance problems in the modern world, I guess. Aziz Ansari, the comedian and actor and now writer, has just come out with a book called Modern Romance. He teamed up with a sociologist from New York University, Eric Kleinenberg, and the two of them traveled around the globe to take the pulse of romance in the early 21st century. One stop was in Tokyo, where Ansari tried to figure out why marriage and birth rates in Japan are plummeting. He says he came across some eye-opening statistics.
Females aged 16 to 24, 46% despise sexual contact. And then for men, it's what, like about 25% in that same age range despise sexual contact.
Yeah, it's not that they're not interested. They despise it.
Despise is a harsh word. I mean, as I said before, despise, it's like you see some breasts and you're like, get them away from me. I despise those. I despise sexuality.
You found that a lot of young people in Japan are very plugged into technology that might help them connect, but yet they couldn't really be bothered to date. Do you think that maybe the kind of presence, the omnipresence of technology is distracting them from sex?
Well, that is one of the things that they talk about with the herbivore man, which is the term they give to these guys that are not interested in dating or sex or marriage. And they say, oh, they're so wrapped up in games and things like that. If I comment on that, I'm just speculating. But I do think what was interesting was you would think, oh, the Japanese, they're so embracing of technology that they'd be using it for dating and romance. But online dating and those things haven't really taken off. And it seems to kind of clash with their culture in different ways. For example, you know, a big part of online dating is taking profile pictures, posting photos of yourself. Mm. And in their culture, it's kind of douchey to do that, as it used to be here at one time. And
why? Is it just kind of self-promotion is not a thing to do?
Yeah, it seems very narcissistic. You know, it's just totally different from here, where all people want to do is take selfies all day. But there, it's very narcissistic. So they don't post photos of themselves. They just post photos of random stuff. And I ask, like, what kind of photos? And they're like, oh, they'll post a photo of maybe their cat or a rice cooker. There was like a profile
Cherished
photo
possession.
Of a rice cooker. A guy's like, hey, I can make rice, let's do this. There's another place we talk to people a lot that was really interesting to me is in Qatar, in Doha, and just seeing how things work in that kind of society where it's like so crazy religious and you can get in trouble for even holding hands with someone of the opposite sex. And then you see how technology is really changing the game with, you know, something like Snapchat. Now people are like sending photos to each other, like, you know, explicit photos sometimes. You're not supposed to like be mingling with people of the opposite sex. So what they do is they'll use Facebook to like coordinate these parties in hotel rooms. And they'll just tell everyone, hey, everyone go to like room 503. And everyone just kind of sneaks in there and they're like having fun and mingling with people of the opposite sex. And
just being with the opposite sex.
I mean, I think it's more just kind of just hanging. Yeah. Not necessarily just a crazy, it's not like a crazy swinger scene from what I gathered. But even that, it's a big deal.
So in Japan, with the kind of absence of romance, what are men doing sexually? I mean, we know the stereotypes of sexual activity in Japan. Did you find the reality to match up to that bizarre perception?
Well, there is what someone once brilliantly referred to as a relationship replacement industry. You know, there's all sorts of things like, you know, there's these devices called a Tenga, which is just kind of a masturbation device. There's places people go, like, there's, you know, there's things like cuddle cafes. There's a thing called host clubs where you go and you sit with your male friends and this woman comes over and kind of hangs out with you. But there's nothing sexual. She's just kind of hanging out with you. It's basically like, you know, kind of like a waitress that's really flirting with you for a long time and has drinks with you, lights your cigarettes, and it's very flirty. And guys go to places like that. And there's a female version of that as well. And there's just kind of this, there's a lot of things they're using to kind of replace their lack of traditional relationships.
What was it like talking to complete strangers about this stuff?
I come off in a way that where it's clear that I'm not, my intent isn't malicious and I'm not going to make fun of you. And I'm really just trying to understand this stuff. So people were very open with me in a way that was really interesting. And people were quick to open up their phones and let me look at like their real text messages and things like that, which is really interesting because you learn so much seeing the actual messages as opposed to someone just reporting what's going on. If you ask someone, for example, the first time we did one of these interviews, I asked this woman, I was like, so what's going on with this guy you've been texting? She's like, oh, it's going pretty well. And I was like, well, can I actually see the messages? And she's like, okay. And then I looked at the messages and the guy's name on her phone was Eric, don't text till Thursday. Like that's, she stored his last name as don't text till Thursday because she's so paranoid about like, oh, I can't like come up over eager or whatever.
Did they know you from Parks and Rec? Did that open anything up?
There were people that were for sure familiar with who I was as a comedian, and that definitely helped them be more comfortable for sure.
So in Argentina and Buenos Aires, you find a very different scene where men are super aggressive in pursuing women, and texting is kind of key to pursuit there, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's the opposite of Japan. If Japan is the world of the herbivore man, then Buenos Aires is the land of the ribeye-eating maniac.
Cro-Magnon.
Yeah, just really sexually aggressive, rampant, just cheating and sex. Like, it's just such an insane sexual culture everywhere. And
do they
it
even
sometimes
need to text?
Gets a little scary. It just, you know, there's guys that are just like, just messaging so many women and just trying to just, you know, really go after it and in a very aggressive way that sometimes can be a little scary.
So let me posit a bottom line here and see if you agree. Tinder may seem like a mercenary way to spend the night with someone, but the whole world is just as messed up. True or false?
Tinder seems to be like a thing that people are quick to say like, oh, it's evidence of how people are shallow or whatever. But to me, it's really not. If you look at it, it's a cynical view to kind of dismiss that thing, because really, like, all right, well, what happens at any bar or party or anything? You're walking around, you're seeing people's faces, and when you see people, you're like, no, 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 yes, and then you see a face, and you look at it, and you're like, that face, it feels good looking at the face. I'm going to go up to the person, and then you walk up to them, and you guys start talking, and maybe something happens. To me, that's the same exact thing as Tinder. It's just, you know, a new form. It's like kind of a modern version of that.
You often joke about your parents who were born in southern India and how they found love. And you've got a whole show coming up on Netflix, Master of None, that mm-hmm. will be somewhat autobiographical. Tell us about your conversation with your dad about how he and your mom got together.
Well, my parents had an arranged marriage. They're married in India. And I asked my dad, I was like, well, how did that happen? He's like, well, you know, I told my parents I was ready to get married. They talked to some families they knew. And they introduced me to some women. And then I eventually met your mom. And that was the person I picked to get married to. I was like, well, how many women did you meet? And he was like, two. And I was like, two? Like, well, what was wrong with the first lady? And he's like, she was a little bit too tall. And then... then he, like, met my mom, was like, all right, perfect height. Let's do this. And they got married like a week later. And that does seem like really crazy, right? But then I went and talked to women and men in retirement homes in America, and they talked about how they got married, and it wasn't that different, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it may seem really foreign, but in some strange way, all your dad did was really swipe Tinder once and then found the face
he
liked.
Exactly. You're right.
Would you ever do that, though, as crazy as it seems, an arranged marriage?
No, I think, you know, anyone growing up now in you know, America and this culture is kind of instilled this idea of marrying this perfect person and a soulmate and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, we're a generation that has more options than anyone. We want to meet, like, a million people before we say yes to someone. We don't want to meet two or three. You know, you meet so many different people throughout your life. The idea of settling down that quickly, I think, would be terrifying to most people that have grown up here.
You know, some people, some critics find it kind of odd that a stand-up comic can crank out a book that's pretty thoughtful like this. Does that irk you when you hear those critiques?
No, I get that. I mean, you don't expect a comedian to write a sociology book that has, like, some academic heft. Like, it's never really been done before. I can't think of anything similar, so that doesn't surprise me. But there was one thing I read sometimes I read, like, oh, Aziz Ansari, oh, well, he seems like an unexpected guide for this, you know, oh, this young man from immigrant parents from India. It's like, oh, so if I was, like, a white guy, it wouldn't be unexpected? Like, that's kind of racist. Like, why is it unexpected? Because my parents are from a different country? I grew up here for, you know, I was born in South Carolina, grew up for, you know, alive in America for 32 years, dated just as much as any other, you know, person that was born here in my age. So that offended me. But the kind of surprise that I wrote a thoughtful book with academic heft to it doesn't bother me.
How's your love life these days? On the ascent or descent?
Well, I'm with my girlfriend for about 2 years, and it's going good. But, you know, I do think 2 years is kind of the time where things get a little bit trickier, because it's not just about, like, having fun. It's like, oh, you're also trying to maintain this relationship and you know, figure out how you're building a life together. So it's a little bit murkier. I'm kind of past the kind of just like the pure fun stage, but I love my girlfriend very much and we're very happy together.
Writer, stand-up comic, and actor Aziz Ansari. His new book is called Modern Romance. Great to meet you, and thanks for the interview.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for nice, thoughtful questions. It was a fun conversation.
A year ago, the news was full of stories about unaccompanied kids from Central America fleeing gang violence by heading north. Reporter Julia Longoria, stationed WNYC, caught up with some of those kids after they'd made it to Hempstead, New York, a town on Long Island. The kids had reunited with their families, but at the beginning of last school year, they had a rough start. It was difficult even getting registered for school. Now Julia's checked back in with one Hempstead school district to see how the children are adjusting to life in the United States.
All right, so do you go to this school here?
No, we attend Hamsa High School.
Ah, okay, got it.
Jessica and Maria go to high school on a tree-lined street. But when I meet them, they're checking out another school, downtown. It opened last year, and it's still a little bit of a mystery to them.
This school, I just know that the kids that come from their country attend this school.
It doesn't look like a school because it's a converted bus depot next to a Dunkin' Donuts and a pharmacy. But it's where students like René Pineda have been going to class. He's 17 and from El Salvador.
La misión es aprender el inglés.
Walking out of class, he says his mission here is to learn English. He seems pretty chill about it, considering what he did last summer. He trekked almost 3,000 miles from El Salvador, crossing the U.S.-Mexico border on foot. He met his dad here, who's been working in Hempstead for 14 years.
Mi futuro que quiero es lograr ser un gran policía.
He says eventually he wants to study to be a cop. But when he tried to register at the high school, the one on the tree-lined street, officials told him there's no room here. Come back later. Then a couple weeks passed, and classrooms at this old bus depot opened.
Javier Yanes.
Javier Yanes, another student, chimes in. He also came up last summer from Central America.
Que no es suficiente, Carl.
He says he's not learning enough here. All his classmates speak Spanish. There's nobody to practice English with. School officials wouldn't let me inside this makeshift high school. But a state investigation set off alarms about its low standards. Jason Starr of the New York Civil Liberties Union observed a science class here.
And the teacher was holding up large print photos, and she was saying, like, this is, in Spanish, this is an aguacate. In English, it's avocado, which is not science, right?
He says one kid looked insulted at the level of instruction. Back in November, the students were told this is temporary until there's room at the big school. But by the start of the summer, they were still here. To learn why, I headed to a school board election happening 10 minutes away.
Hi.
Who are you going to vote for?
Some people there said the recently arrived kids from Central America are a real issue in the district. Some have a name for them.
The Border Babies.
That's Thomas Parsley, a community organizer. He gets that the kids here need to go to school. That's their right.
So if these children came unaccompanied, they're still entitled to services and education and everything. And they might need additional social services support also because they don't have anybody. But why here?
Many of the kids I talked to did have someone here, though, a parent or a relative. Central Americans have been settling in Hempstead for decades. It's now about half African American, half Latino. And the schools have been underperforming for years. Low graduation rates, low funding. Some Latino advocates say the new Central American kids are scapegoats for these old problems.
You are all supposed to be for the children.
I want to talk to you because I'm tired of people lying and lying and lying.
Carlos Encarnacion is passing out flyers in support of the only Latina on the school board.
Here, we perceive, you know, like animosity against a group of students because they speak a different language. In my book, that only has one name.
Then things get a little heated.
Let me tell you about the Spanish community.
A fist fight almost breaks out. Shelley Brazley, a school board member, says this kind of thing happens all the time in Hempstead.
Our biggest problem is we just don't talk to each other.
She also blames a lack of school leadership. A state investigation showed the superintendent here was overpaid by $30,000 and didn't do anything to correct it. And she didn't respond to interview requests. The state has stepped in, but not with money. Instead, they asked the school board to appoint a watchdog to make sure all kids are properly registered. School officials say the plan is to close the temporary school this year. But Javier isn't optimistic.
Pero no creo porque dicen unos güeros que está muy lleno el otro, no hay cupo para nosotros. A ver.
He says he still hears the main school is full. He fears he's stuck here. For The World, I'm Julia Longoria, Hempstead, New York.
Coming up, Aleppo Techno here on The World.
The World's Global Nation education coverage is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, supporting communities as they work to end the dropout crisis. AmericanGraduate.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Iran is just like any other place in the world, a country with many different opinions. Some Iranians support the hardline ideology of the Islamic Revolution. Others think Iran should move on. Even families can be divided. My next guest knows about that. Mariam Abolfazli was born in Tennessee to Iranian parents, and she has relatives in Iran who are supporters of the Islamic Republic. She remembers visiting them for the first time back in 2003.
you know, I'm a very progressive person. I was raised in a very progressive family. So it was really different for me to be in family homes where we couldn't be as relaxed or as open, or for me to cover everywhere I went, including inside the home.
With hijab.
Or to see, right, right. Yeah. Or to see little cousins, little girls covered up, or aunts covered up. And
you've got this so great detail about that where your cousin asks you if you like Eminem. What do you say? What's that dialogue like?
Right. I mean, so that was a phase, you know, what was going on in Iran was this, it was like still Khatami in power. And Khatami was all about this dialogue of civilizations, and NGOs were sort of booming. They were
Khatami,
already starting
the former
to come.
President.
Right, yeah. Right. We were hearing and seeing this sort of fun party scene, this alternative sort of pushing the edges style on the streets. And I was at 20, you know, 4 or 5, I was really intrigued to be part of that, watch that, see what that is. And I remember we were walking on the street and there's all these, you know, fascinating haircuts and styles and a lot of, you know, very good looking guys on the streets. And I'm looking at them and my cousin asks me, do you like Eminem? And I say, yeah, you know, he's interesting. He's talented. And I hate him. Mm. And I thought,
why did she hate him?
She just thought he was rude. She thought he was vulgar. She thought disrespectful.
There's something kind of refreshing about that, because that's the debate that's been the debate about Eminem in this country, too.
Sure.
So now there's this nuclear deal between Iran and the U.S. You've been in touch with your family again back in Tehran, thanks in part to social media apps. What's been their reaction to the deal?
So I've talked to people from both sides in the family, and from the sort of most conservative side, they're not really keen on the deal, I have to say. And it's been interesting. It's for a variety of reasons, obviously. But there's definitely this distrust, this ongoing distrust of the United States and whether it's going to stick with its promises. And they think the United States has broken promises in the past, and they've been shocked by some of the things the U.S. has done, you know, things like helping with the Taliban and then the axis of evil statements and stuff like that. So they're really wary of that. And then the last thing that they always say is that the U.S. has never trusted Iran, and it won't. And there's sort of fundamental differences, and they attribute that to a variety of things, including the Israeli lobby. So that's sort of the main reasons they're not really trustful of this agreement at all.
Mariam, you write that the day the nuclear deal was signed, your family group on this messaging application you use was noticeably silent about the whole thing. So you write congratulations, just to kind of put in your opinion. And your grandmother writes in response, good luck is not found, it's built. What did she mean by that?
Yeah. There's a sort of rule in the family not to engage in political conversations for the reasons of those divergences that have happened. So that's another reason why no one wanted to dive in and start telling what they honestly thought. But I haven't spoken to her directly, but I would say she's probably pro the deal and sees it as a big effort on Iran's side to make it happen, not something that just magically came out of anywhere. So I think that's what she's talking about.
But a lot of conservatives and hardliners in Iran are dubious about the deal. And interestingly, a lot of conservatives here in the U.S. are dubious, and Obama's going to have to convince them of its merits. Do you see any time when, like, these two groups of conservatives could reconcile?
You know, I was listening to the Kerry hearings this morning, and it's really tough. It feels very similar to the debate in Iran. It's so entrenched, and it's so kind of closed to alternative views that it's really hard to imagine what it would take to open up the perspective a little bit, to be like, oh, this is why things aren't working. This is why this might be the only way that things will work. Because it sounds like people are really kind of digging their heels in on what they believe and what they're afraid of. So I honestly think if this deal could go forward and there could be some face-saving milestones on both sides, where I said I'm going to do this, you said you're going to do this, we both do this, and we do that for 2 years, 3 years, I think it will take a lot of the air out of a lot of the discussion on all sides. I think that's probably the best way to change the direction of this relationship.
Mariam Abolfazli has been telling me about the nuclear deal with Iran and what she and her family there in Iran think about it. Mariam, thanks very much. Great to meet you.
No problem. Thank you.
I want to tell you about a Syrian musician and artist named Zemo and his music project Hello Psych Aleppo, as in the Syrian city of Aleppo, but in a psychedelic vein. Zima says Hello Sakalepo is about Arab heritage music and electronic sounds. In this track, Tobaya Buya, he samples the late Egyptian crooner Abdel Halim Hafez. Zima's real name is Samer Sayem Eldar, and he believes in the power of music to express a sense of place. Even before the Syrian conflict erupted in 2011, Zima was creating sounds like this in his hometown of Aleppo.
Back in Aleppo, I was just like playing around on software, trying to make anything. And then I uploaded these pieces online and people started to listen to this music and liking it.
Especially in the indie scene in Beirut. Zima actually moved to Beirut in 2012. He went looking for an art gallery to display his paintings, but as the violence heated up back in Aleppo, his parents told him to stay put in Beirut for his own safety. His parents themselves left for Jordan, and it's from his home in Beirut now that Zima is building the Hello Sakalepo project. Zima's latest release under the Hello Sakalepo marquee is this tune, Shaba. And what's really striking to me is the music video that goes with it. You can check it out at PRI.org. It's a cartoon, and in it, an animated Zima is watching actual images on TV from Aleppo. Zima recently told my colleagues at the BBC that he crowdsourced the footage.
I asked people online to send me any personal footage they took in the city. So it's more something of a collective memory, something that we all share, you know? The whole process was very, bittersweet.
As the video continues, Zima transforms into a bird and flies over Aleppo, as it was before the war.
Being a bird at the end symbolizes a lot of longing. My body is roaming all over the world, but my soul is back there.
So while Zima is in Beirut, his soul is back in Aleppo, a city he's not sure when or even if he'll ever be able to return to. Again, the video is at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being here.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, Cindy and Howard Rachofsky, and the Billy and Dodie Crockett Advised Fund of the Dallas Foundation, by the Ford Foundation, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the Annenberg Foundation, Advancing a Better Tomorrow Through Visionary Leadership Today, annenbergfoundation.org, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.